When I announced our topic, some of my favorite fools, one of my favorite friends came and said, I'll have to be there. I want to know if I'm on the list. So lest anyone is seated tense at his place, let me assure you that present company is accepted. Although you'll discover that if I am somewhat impatient with stupidity, my favorite fools are anything but foolish. Every sermon begins in an experience of the rabbi. Something we have read, something we have seen, something we have heard or overheard strikes home. This theme began in the quiet of my study. It was late at night and I was reading a new English translation of the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is a library of Hebrew writings from the most recent of the pre-Christian centuries. This literature is contemporaneous with the last books of the Bible, and it was not included in the biblical canon for a variety of reasons. Some of the material is too brief. Some of it does not pass literary or philosophic muster. Some of it simply duplicates material found already in the Bible and would be redundant. Some of it is excessive in its eschatology, in its apocalypse, in its dealing with the last visionary things. Perhaps the most famous of the books of the Apocrypha are the four histories of the Maccabees, the chronicles of the history of the Jews, which underlies our holiday of Hanukkah. But this particular evening, my eye had been drawn to the 51 chapters which constitute the book of Ecclesiasticus, or as it is more commonly known, the Wisdom of Ben Sirach. Joshua ben Sirach was an influential and important citizen of Jerusalem some 2160 years ago. He was by profession teacher, or rhetor, as they were called in those days. And at the end of what was obviously a most successful and respected career, this wise man set down a brief in which he brought together and capsuled the best of his judgment and the clearest of his understanding. Now the ancients, as you know, delighted in creating proverbs and maxims which would be compact, where the language was rich, suggestive of a dozen or more meanings. And it was this language of the proverb, of the maxim, which Joshua ben Sirach used throughout the book. This précis of his teaching, originally written in Hebrew, was translated some 50 years after his death by his grandson into Greek. The Hebrew original was lost until 2 years ago. And our modern translations are all taken from this labor of love by the dedicated grandson of this ancient teacher. But our interest this morning is not to the recensions of the text or to its history, but to the man and to his writings. Ben Sirach was a worldly wise man, shrewd, a capable observer, eminently sensible. Ben Sirach can be read, therefore, by the unsophisticated, by the gullible, by the naive, with great profit. It reminds us that we live in this world, not in an angelic world, that we must guard ourselves and protect ourselves, that we cannot simply be fooled with the love of others and great compassion. And it can be read by any of us who conceive of our own eye as being rather sharp, and who pride ourselves in our understanding of mankind. For it is always of benefit to read the capable, shrewd observations of another. Let me cite you two examples of the wisdom of Ben Sirach. The first is a series of lines addressed to a father who has a tendency to be overly generous, overly indulgent of his family and of his sons. To son or wife, to brother or friend, do not give power over yourself as long as you live. Do not give your property to another, lest you change your mind and must ask for it. While you are still alive and have your breath in you, do not let anyone take your place. For it is better that your children should ask from you than that you should look to the hand of your sons. Or take this observation, this monition, addressed to those who are tempted to take up the well-meant generosity, the offered and proffered hospitality of another. The essentials for life are water and bread and clothing and a house to cover one's nakedness. Better is the life of a poor man under the shelter of his roof than sumptuous food in another man's house. Be content with little or much. It is a miserable life to go from house to house. Where you are a stranger, you may not open your mouth. You play the host and provide drink without being thanked. Besides this, you will overhear bitter words. Come here, stranger. Prepare the table, and if you have anything at hand, let me have it to eat. Or give place, stranger, to an honored person, my brother. He has come to stay with me. I need my house. These things are hard to bear for a man who has feeling. And indeed they are. As anyone who has been forced by circumstance to accept the protracted hospitality of another can attest. There is much of benefit, then, in these teachings of Ben Sirach. But I'll confess to you that that night, as I reread these chapters, I was filled with a growing sense of irritation. Ben Sirach put me off. The Olympian ease with which he dispensed judgment was just too godlike for me. Life is simply too tangled and complicated to be this sure of your judgments. Besides this, Ben Sirach is not above, as we say in the vernacular, tooting his own horn, building himself up in the eyes of another and making sure that posterity would understand his significant role in Jewish life in his day. He who is wise, he says over and over again, meaning himself, he who is wise among his people will inherit honor and his name will live forever. Ben Sirach, I suspect for all of his wisdom, was given to the ordinary human failing of vanity, and he may even have been somewhat a pompous man. As I reread this text, I thought myself of this simple truth, that wisdom brings along with itself its own evil. I understood what Jeremiah meant when he said, Al yit halel hacham b'chochmato, let not a wise man pride himself in his wisdom. Why not? Gandhi provides us the answer. More than any other man in our century, Gandhi had to deal every day of his life with the Ben Sirachs of the world, with British functionaries, the governors and authorities in India who, by virtue of an Oxford education and a certificate from the British Foreign Office, knew that they knew what was best for the Indian. They too had this arrogance of intellect. And once when an American was interviewing Gandhi, he asked Gandhi, what was it that he found, in which he found most heartache and most unease? What had given him the most trouble in life? And Gandhi's answer was simple and direct. The hard-headedness of the educated. The hard-headedness of the educated. Wisdom has a way of bringing with itself its own ugliness, and that ugliness is arrogance. I doubt that any of us would have taken pleasure in the company of Ben Sirach. He would have known what was best for us, and he would have told us so. Oh, he might have said that he had learnt with his understanding that if a philosopher is stumbling and halting in his phrasing and equivocates in his language, no one will listen to you. That you have to speak the truth straight out. And there's a certain truth to this. But I personally prefer Jeremiah. Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. Better a truth unheard than a truth shouted, which is no longer heard or useful. As As I read Ben Sirach, as I sensed the man, as I found myself put off by his vanity and by his intellectual arrogance, I found also that there was something deeper here in my irritation. What was it? As I read these chapters of wisdom, I found that they did not satisfy me. Here was an understanding, insight into the human situation, which was simply not sufficient. What was lacking? Was it common sense? Good sense? Not at all. Ben Sirach is an eminently responsible and responsive human being. He knew how to bargain. He knew not to take another's promises at face value. He knew not to dream dreams which were implausible. He knew even to rein in rather tightly his own illusions. What then was missing? Was it good breeding, manners? Again, not at all. Ben Sirach reads in part as an Oriental Emily Post. Was it a sense of community, the responsibilities of man to his city? Not at all. Ben Sirach speaks often of our responsibility to our neighbors. And I somehow imagine him as a member of the Judean Red Cross and of the Jerusalem United Appeal and sitting on a number of hospital boards and agency affiliates. What then was it? What's missing? Life. A sense of passion, a dash of the daring, some enthusiasm, a willingness sometime in his life to let the heart rule the head. I suspect that when Ben Sirach married, he married, quote, well. He looked over the field and he found for himself the wife who had exactly the most reasonable of qualities that a wife of a teacher in Jerusalem should have. I suspect that it came to politics. His politics were eminently sensible. I doubt that he ever carried a placard or that he ever wrote a letter in protest. He was simply not this type of human being. He lacked the ability to reach out into life and to grab for it, to be passionate in some cause. Instead of passion, we find in Ben Sirach the philosophy of caution. Seek not that which is too high for thee. Or again, a wise man should be cautious always. Or again, dreams give wings to fools. Or again, do not go on a path full of hazards, and do not stumble over stony ground. Guard yourself. Be careful in every act. Ben Sirach was a Stoic, in both the classic and the contemporary sense of that word. He was a realist. He was resigned to the vagaries of life and of chance. He was determined to be in control of himself, calm at all times. He was determined to be disciplined, to accept life with sturdy strength and a rather strong, resigned philosophy. Ben Sirach and his contemporaries, and they are legion, are courageous men. They're experienced men. They're hard-headed men. What they lack is simply the ability to expose themselves to life in the raw, or rather to expose their heart, to let their heart at some point rule their critical judgment. They simply do not feel that joining the Peace Corps or protesting in Selma, or protesting in Washington, changes the affairs of the world. Power politics is to them a matter of naked power. It's whom you know, whom you control, and who controls you. That's the beginning and the end of it. These men are realists. They feel a great responsibility to their business, to their profession. They feel that men are foolish who allow themselves the luxury of causes. Your causes, your excesses will be remembered. You may be denied a promotion. Far better that you stick to your own last and you do the first things first, those things which are critical in your future, in your step up the ladder. Somehow I can imagine Ben Sirach saying to his son, My boy, I can't tell you what you ought to do, you know that. But I can't but believe that being with me this summer in the office will be a far greater use to you than being in the boondocks in Mississippi. It's not, as you know, that I have anything against integration, but that's their problem. Boy, this is a dog-eat-dog world, and if you want to be top dog, you better grow up and stop being the child who brings home the... Will one of the ushers come forward, please? Ben Sirach's is the voice of a cautious wisdom. And his is a necessary wisdom. For there are men and women to whom virtue, to whom excess itself is a virtue. There are men and women who look on the ordinary responsibilities of life as pure convention, as restrictive. There are men and women who will not simply look after themselves and after their own, and these can read Ben Sirach with profit. Every century, every generation has its Don Quixotes, heedlessly, foolishly, senselessly seeking new windmills at which to tilt. But I confess that it is a simple truth of history, that cautious wisdom does not build civilization. It is only those who are foolish enough to let the heart rule the head. It is only those who are willing to plunge into life, to reach out for something beyond the ordinary rewards of the daily routine. It is only these who build civilization. Dreams, Ben Sirach said, give wings to fools, and sometimes they do. Can just imagine the foolishness of the young man who tells his father, "No, Dad, I can't join the office. I'm not ready to settle down yet. I don't know why." And I can just see the father turning on the son and saying to him, "Boy, you've got to settle down. Now, I know that if you had a musical genius, I know that if you had a scientific talent which was certain, I wouldn't force you to come back here and work with me. I've built this up for you, but if you were built differently than I am, well, then go ahead. But you're just stewing around. You have no set purpose. When I tell you to come back, that the time is now, that I need you, you tell me I've simply got to be left alone. Give me a chance to find myself. I don't know where I'm going, but I can't walk in this smooth way. Well, the father was a wise man and the son perhaps foolish. But was Abraham a fool? Abraham came of a settled, wealthy tribe in Ur of the Chaldees. Abraham was the eldest son of the chief of the clan. Abraham could look forward to growing responsibility, ultimately to some measure of power. Abraham had no settled purpose. He didn't know where he was going. He didn't know why he had to go. He simply needed a greater freedom, some elbow room to find himself. And Abraham went. Was he a fool? Could Judaism have forged the vision of the one God if it had not wrenched itself out physically from the paganism and the polytheism of the world about it? History has a way of making the fools into heroes and transforming them into saints. And no sensible man, no cautious man, no reasonable man comes home after a day's work and says to his wife, "Dear, I've had a vision, I've got to go out and save the world." Well, was Moses a fool? Moses had a vision. And I can just see Jethro, his father-in-law, saying to him, "Calm down. It's the heat. Let Zipporah nurse you for a while. You can't simply chuck your responsibilities in some fool's errand. You think you're going to go to Egypt and get in to see the Pharaoh and get him to allow several hundred thousand of his best slaves to leave? Boy, you've been on the sun too long. Take a few days off. Pharaoh won't see you. He'll order you clapped into irons. And if he does see you, he'll see you simply to mock at you, to make you the joke of the court. And all you'll succeed in doing is to add another widow and another orphan to my responsibilities. Take it easy, Moses. Take a few days off. Come back to your senses. Is that too much to ask of you?" Well, it was. And Moses went. And you know, there are people for whom the conventional responsibilities, even the extraordinary love that a husband feels for a wife and a father for a son, who chuck these over because there is a broader responsibility. They have a role to play on the world scene. If Moses had stayed at home, if he listened to the wise words, if he had abided the good advice, the slaves would have remained slaves. Israel would have remained enchained. Monotheism, the great face of the Western world, might never have been born. Fools have a way of writing history, of writing great history, the history of our civilization. Perhaps what I am saying can be best summed up in the biblical legend of Jonah. You know it well. Jonah was one of these men who was in tune with Ben Sirach. Jonah believed that you should not reach for that which is too high for you, that the way of the wise man is a cautious way, that one ought not unnecessarily to take a hazardous road. And when God came to Jonah, who was busy puttering in his garden and playing with his grandchildren, and said to him, "Jonah, I have a mission for you." Jonah said, "No, no thank you, find somebody else." And God said, "Go." And Jonah said, "Aren't there enough rolling stones in the world, unsettled people? Why do you have to pick on me? I pay my taxes, I'm a good citizen, I ask only to be left alone, to live and to let live." But God said, "Go." And Jonah went. But he went the wrong way. Tried to escape. But no one can escape responsibility. And Jonah was brought back and he went to Nineveh, the great city. And he preached to Nineveh of God's anger for its wickedness. And the people of Nineveh repented. And then God repented of his verdict. And the city was saved. And this caused Jonah an anger beyond that which he had originally known when he had been uprooted from his garden. The Bible tells us that Jonah went outside the city and sat out on a hillock overlooking this great walled place, grumbling all the while to himself, miserable about the frustration of his mission, Here he'd gone into the streets, into the public square of Nineveh, the capital of the world, and he told them, if you don't repent, God will destroy you. And the people had made some motions towards a repentance, and the God had rescinded his judgment, and he'd walked out of the city seeming to be a fool. He had promised destruction, and it had not come. So Jonah was sitting outside, pitying himself, grumbling to himself. And God took pity on Jonah. And God, according to the legend, caused a great gourd to grow. And the gourd cast some shade over Jonah, protecting him from the searing rays of the Near Eastern sun. And Jonah at least began to feel some kind of physical pleasure. And then God brought a parasite, and the parasite blotted the gourd, and the gourd withered. And the sun beat down again unmercifully, and Jonah redoubled his grumblings, his petulance. Here, now he was physically ill at ease, unhappy with himself physically. And God said to him, Jonah, art thou truly angry? And Jonah answered, indeed I am. And God said, Jonah, art thou angry for this gourd? And Jonah said, I miss it. And God said to him, should I not have pity on a great city of 120,000 people when thou hast so much anger and so much concern for one little gourd, which thou neither madest to grow nor laborest for it? What does the legend teach us? That the Jonahs of the world, the Ben Siruchs of this world, and many of us live in a narrow and circumscribed place. Our concerns are safety, physical well-being, the protection of our family, paycheck, promotion. This is our world, and we operate responsively within these four walls. But they're narrow walls, they're constricting walls. Outside these walls, there's a great surging universe. There's a responsibility which we cannot throw over. And when this responsibility comes and reaches in and says, we need you, we cannot simply say, I have no time. Or what you ask of me is too time-consuming, or it'll be enervating. My first responsibility is at home. We must say, here I am. This is my role in history. Do with me as I must. But there's a second meaning to this legend of Jonah. What is God saying to Jonah when he caused this gourd to grow and then destroyed the gourd and contrasted the gourd and Jonah's concern for it with the city and all of its people? Simply this, Jonah, man, I would not have disturbed you for a trifle. Ordinarily, your responsibilities are within these four narrow walls. But when it's a matter of human welfare, when it's a broad concern, when a city is involved, when a nation, when peace, righteousness, justice, when these are at stake, then you must walk out the gate of your narrow world. Then you must have concern, not for yourself, your physical well-being, not for your well-laid plans for advancement and promotion. Now you must have concern for the human situation, for what the world needs and what you must give to it. Ben Siruch said, reach not for that which is too high for thee. Dreams give wings to fools. And indeed they do. And if we are truly foolish, we fly uselessly, and we endanger our lives pointlessly. But thank God for the dreams which do give wings to the wise fools of the world. Thank God for the dreams which draw us out of ourselves. Thank God for the dreams which remind us that we are part, one and another, of something called humanity. That our fate is interdependent. Because our four walls, these narrow, restrictive walls, will not protect us when upheaval shakes the society, when war is waged by our nation, when poverty cries out in the street for redress. We have a responsibility. We must dream. Indeed, we cannot deny our dreams, but we must be responsive to them. Rather than Ben Siruch, I commend to you the book of Ecclesiastes, the wisdom of Solomon. Solomon says in his book, Yakar me chachma u mi kavod, sichlut ma'at. far better than all the riches of the world and all the honor that man can bestow upon another, is a little bit of folly. This is what Heine meant when he said, "Who ne'er has been foolish, he ne'er has been wise." This is what Jeremiah meant when he said, "Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his wealth. But let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I, the Lord, executeth mercy and righteousness and justice in the earth, for in these things do I delight." In the doing of mercy, in the executing of justice, in the joining in righteous cause, we are foolish. We are going against our immediate self-interest. But this is the way that delights God. This is the way that validates our birth. This is the way that is ultimately the glory of human life. Yakar mechachma umikavod, sichlut ma'at. Far more precious than riches and honor is a little bit of folly. Amen.